Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to the Power Talk interview portion. And today, I'm fortunate enough to be home, which I never get to do these interviews in. And I have the privilege of being with a man that I'm sure you heard of. His name is Dr. Stephen Covey. And I've been an admirer of Stephen's for many years. I feel like he is a force for good in the business community, and I think in our culture as a whole. He's one of those unique individuals that talks about honor and human dignity and character and who really lives it. And I have tremendous respect for you, Stephen, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have you be here.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be in your humble abode.
Well, thank you.
We just call it home.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. I want to make sure people know a little bit more about you, those maybe who haven't heard of you. You're the author of the national best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And what I love about you, personally, is that you're about one of the most congruent human beings that I know. And that's one of the things I value most. Your caring and your compassion and your desire to help people remember that they're not a stimulus response being, but that they can choose the way to live. And that their need for contribution and interdependence, those themes I think are so important in our society today, and that honor is more important than things like moods or temporary desires. I've really tried to base my work on principles, values. You do the same. So I'd like to get into those, but I think before we do anything else, what I'd love to do, if you'd be willing to allow us, is find out more about your background. What made you decide to become a professor, and then how did that evolve into the 7 habits?
Well, when I did my undergraduate and then I did my mission work, I became very interested in training, developing leaders. So when I went to the Harvard Business School, I focused on the human side in the second year, where you were given a lot of electives. And then I thought that teaching had high leverage opportunities, so I started to teach at the Brigham Young University, and I taught there for about 5 years. And then I went on another mission to Ireland for 3 years, and then I came back, went into the administration of Brigham Young University, then back into teaching after a period of time. And then I decided I would really like to make an impact on the world. So I kind of distilled the essence of what I'd been learning working with organizations and people over a period of, I guess, about 20 years into the concept that private victories always precede public victories.
Yes.
And that out of true, deep character strength lies the power of both courage and compassion. And to me, the unique juxtaposition of courage and compassion is the essence of the foundation of an interdependency in the world. And so I became enamored by that idea, and I got into it, and I began to think, now, what would help produce, see, this private victory? Well, to take responsibility for your own life. So that's habit one, see?
Right.
And then, well, what is your life about? That's habit two.
Right.
And then to live by it, that's habit three. So in a sense, those three kind of fundamental ideas comprise the foundation for the private victory. Now, what's the public victory? Well, it's that you essentially regard other people with great respect and dignity and treat them accordingly. And how do you solve problems then? You have to listen to them first before you seek to be listened to. And then you try to go into synergy, which means you create something that is better than what either proposed initially. And out of those three represent the essence of the public victory, or the essence of interdependency, which is what life is, see? So then I started working with that material. You know how it goes as you go out training, you get a lot of feedback and you hone the material.
And then you figure out how to keep that by reinforcing it through the,
right?
The whole idea of sharpening the saw.
Right, and sharpening the saw, that's habit seven. So then I decided, but I don't want to just be a speaker. I really want to get this thing institutionalized, and I want to see it has carry-on value, see,
right,
to really impact lives. So that's why I left BYU and went into setting up a business, and takes us where we are today, I guess.
Well, we have very similar goals. I had the same things that shaped me. I looked at people doing speeches, and I thought, you know, how long will the impact last? And as you know, building an organization requires a little bit more energy and impact and focus than just going out and doing the speeches, but it gives you the opportunity to continue to touch people.
The real key I have found is to train people inside their own organizations.
Yeah. Their own champions, if you would.
Yes, so that they then start teaching others, who in turn teach others, practice it, report back on their experiences in both teaching and applying, so that they start to get a sense of responsibility toward the material and accountability.
And momentum.
It does. It does create a momentum. There's a natural momentum of enthusiasm because it actually impacts lives. So when people come back, they say, what did you do? Well, I tried this circle of influence idea, and I just focused only on the things that I could work on. I can't tell you what that did to my marriage, or what it did with this teenage son that I've had nothing but headaches with,
yes.
Or what it did in my executive team. Then they report, really? Well, it didn't work with me. Why did you do it? And they learn from each other. It becomes a kind of synergistic learning environment. So that, in a sense, my speech maybe was a catalyst to start it off, but in all sincerity, the power is when they do it with themselves.
Yes, I agree.
One of the little things I use in my presentations is a compass. And I ask people at the beginning of the speech to point north, to close their eyes and point north. And usually about 30-40% actually have it correct. But that's the way it is with most people in most organizations. They really don't know where true north is. Yeah. Then I say, well, true north, you notice, is an external reality. That's what principles are. See, values are internal. Principles are external. And the key is to get our value system, which is the arrow of the compass. I gradually show that the compass never changes. True north never changes. But our value system is manifested in our habit patterns, and in an organization they're called our practices, is to get into alignment with true north or with principles. Then you get in harmony with the laws of nature.
Yes.
You get in harmony with what Carl Jung called the unconscious, the collective unconscious that pervades all humanity, regardless of their upbringing, their religion, their cultural heritage, their scripting, whatever it is. There is something far more basic and generic at that level than most people know about. And I find that no matter where we go in developing mission statements, if you get enough people interacting freely, feeling safe in the interaction, and where they're really synergistic, you know, where they're learning, yes, from each other, and also when they're very informed on the full nature of the problems in their situation, all the mission statements become the same. They all know where True North is.
So in what way?
They all basically describe not the vision part of the mission statement, what their enterprise is about, but the principles part of the mission statement always basically deals with four things. Our physical being and our economic well-being, see? So the principle there is fundamentally to be fair toward people. Mm-hmm. And then the social part, that is having to do with relationships, mm-hmm, and the creation of a culture that has what I call an immune system in it, so we can handle any problems that come down, mm-hmm, the pike, and has this great ability to solve problems regardless. The principle there has to do with how you treat people. Kindness and dignity and so forth, and respect. You see people as a separate individual of equal worth to yourself. Then the third area they always deal with, inevitably, is how do you develop people? That's the psychological nature. How do you identify their talents? Then how do you develop them? Then how do you use them? That's the missing area in this country in most organizations, is how to use people's talents.
Yes.
The top people are being used, but the many other levels are not empowered at all. And that's why we have such a hard time competing in a global marketplace against major organizations from the Far East and from Europe that are more fully using people's capacities and talents. Then the fourth area has to do with, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? It's the spiritual nature. That is, are you making a difference? Do you really make a contribution? Do you add value? Does your life matter? In my next project I'm working on, I'm essentially bringing this together, and I'm calling it The Fire Within. You'd like that.
Yeah.
The Fire Within, to live, see? To live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Wow. Trying to show how the four basic needs. And then I'm going to try to show how that pertains to every individual, every organization, and every society.
Fantastic. Tell me, you know, one of the major frames of reference that have shaped you is the whole concept of paradigms. Understanding that rather than just trying to change a behavior or a strategy or a single value, to really change the entire system, the entire way of looking at life, the entire belief systems. It's one of the things that we share in common. It's one of the things a lot of our graduates who are listening have experienced through Date with Destiny, a program that we do to make that kind of change happen. What I'm really getting towards is, in the beginning of your book, you shared about one of your children and how your experience with that child helped you to understand how your paradigm was affecting your children. Maybe we could touch on that.
Yeah, that's a key area. In fact, when I wrote the Seven Habits book, our common editor said, you need a grabber there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Some personal experience. And I hesitated to do it. Got my son's kind of struggled out approval to do it. But basically, this was a boy who was in his junior high period of time, and he was kind of backward and awkward and didn't do well in school. He didn't even know how to take tests. He socially seemed to be out of it. Athletically, he was a complete uncoordinated kind of klutz.
And how'd you really feel about it?
And my wife and I would sit and talk with each other about this kid, you know, like, what have we got on our hands? I often say to audiences, the key to your family is how you treat the child that tests you the very most.
Yes.
Because, you see, that's the only child that really tests your own character.
Yeah.
And develops your own character at its outward edge, plus enables the other children to know your love is unconditional.
Yeah.
Well, this boy was putting us through those paces. And we were trying to use what I call the personality ethic, you know, to use a lot of visualization, affirmations, and to get him psyched, and to, you can do it, son, believe you can, come on, hold the bat this way, and then when they pass the ball, throw the ball to you, you just keep your eye on it, and then swing, you know, and then he'd swing before the ball was pitched, and his brothers would just fall apart with laughter, and then I'd get on their backs to get off his back. See, I mean, you can imagine the kind of social dynamic that was taking place. Essentially, the same kind of thing was happening socially and academically. Well, one time I was back in Armonk, New York, with IBM Executive Development Headquarters, talking on the self-fulfilling prophecy and the concept that the perception or the paradigm you have of the world causes your behavior to behave in a certain way, which produces the evidence to support your perception or your paradigm.
Sure.
It's the self-fulfilling prophecy, and when I was teaching it one day, I thought, is it possible this is true with my son, that the problem is not in my son at all? It's in the way I am seeing him, and in the way that I am seeing what the growth process should be for him. See, the difference between training and development, or what's called education, is that training is something you do from the outside. In education, it means to draw out of.
Right.
See, we were into a training process, training our boy. We weren't in an education process at all. We didn't deeply affirm the essential essence of his being and his own timetable. In a sense, we were pressing the nervous definition of society and its timetable upon his growth process, see?
And reinforcing for him that he wasn't enough, in essence, unconsciously, were you not?
Right, we were, and then he was producing the evidence to validate our perception and his perception.
Pygmalion at its best.
It is, and yes. And what happened was that we would protect him from his brothers, and he liked that protection. He got to like it. The whole spirit of codependency that is so popular in the recovery literature today started to get into us. Well, anyway, I began to say to myself, you know, physician, heal thyself. What are you out here teaching this stuff for? And you've got a situation, maybe you yourself have to work. So I talked with Sandra about it.
That's your wife.
My wife, and it was a very kind of difficult experience. It was the toughest part, really, is for the two of us to honestly admit that maybe the problem was in our paradigm, and maybe that paradigm was a product of our own motive structure. That's why I really believe that we lead three lives: our public life, you know, where we're with each other, and our private life, where we go when we go home, we may watch television, or we may read, or we may visit with our loved ones, or so forth. But this key life is the secret life. That's where you go into your heart and examine your motives. What are you really about? And what are you going to align your life to, see? So Sandra and I began to say, really, what is our motives? And we sensed that we were trying to, in a sense, get some, I don't know, social mileage, see? Mm-hmm. Other people to like us, because in the kind of business that you and I are in, people are always looking and observing, and yeah. I kind of like it when people say, wow, what fine children you have. You know what I mean? Build you up a little, and but we came to feel that's a totally unworthy motive.
Yeah.
It's not a sufficient motive.
Yeah.
So we worked internally on ourselves, into our own secret life, as it were, and we commingled our secret life. I think commissioning basically means is co-missioning, commingling the missions of people. And
yes.
Sandra and I found that it was enormously deepening of our relationship to have that experience with this boy. And you know what? We just started to relax and to affirm him and to kind of let go of the kind of social timetable of society. And we let go of our tendency to clone him or to do our thing on him or to train him or to do what I call the personality ethic on him. We just affirmed his worth and value. Initially, he had a hard time because he liked the way we would protect him, but we saw him differently. Yeah. We saw him as a person who had fundamental adequacy. And he started to grow, and in a very rapid way started to grow in all these different dimensions. And even though he achieved real success athletically and academically and socially, that no longer became the overriding criteria. We wouldn't say to ourselves, oh, good, it worked. You don't do something because it works. You do it because it's right. It's principle-based. And principles are natural laws, and they're going to govern regardless. Like it or not, they're going to have their way. So he started to, all of a sudden, achieve more feeling of his own worth and independence. He brought home a straight A-plus report card with one A on it, which means he'd done extra assignments in all those classes. And his brothers looked at that and said, what is that? Whose is that? No, that's your brother. Oh, come on now, really, what's going on here? We said, no, it really is. And he said, well, is he some kind of a genius? And I said, yes, he is. We don't know what kind, but he's got something that's very unique and powerful.
It's pretty important for people to believe that about everyone, I think, don't you?
I think so. I really think so. In fact, he was our fifth child. That affected our relationship with the other four that were still yet coming along.
Yeah.
And now it's affected our relationship with our older children and their children. Yeah. I really believe when we raise our children, we are raising our grandchildren. And that you need to see what you're doing because it's going to carry on into the next generation. Yeah. That doesn't mean if people aren't proactive enough, they can't overcome bad scripting.
Right.
But if you can create the optimum environment for positive scripting, you know, how much more advantage?
I have to rework the system.
Right.
That's neat. That's fabulous.
I often say to audiences, you know, how many crammed and people acknowledge, and they say, that's a value system. Now, how many have ever worked on a farm? And they say, well, there's usually a small percentage. I say, for more than a year, that's a smaller percentage. But I say, did you ever cram? On the farm, you know, forget the plant, flake off all summer, then hit it real hard in the fall to bring in the harvest, you know, and the audience usually kind of breaks up with that because see how ludicrous it is?
Yeah.
See, they know in their consciences already. So then I say, okay, now tell me what's business like, farm or school?
Oh,
and they always are torn a little on that, so I say, let me get more specific. Long-term business, and you know what everyone says like this? Farm.
Yeah.
Short-term business, school. Marriage, farm. Raising teenagers, hard farming. In fact, the other day down in Australia, someone screamed out, prison farming.
I don't know if that's the most empowering metaphor.
But see, people know. They know the difference between values and principles.
You know, if you don't plant in the spring, you're going to weep in the fall.
Right.
Oh, that's right. That's interesting. Oh, gosh. I think so many of the problems of society, and I'm curious if you agree with me on this, have come from the fact that the paradigms of society have changed so rapidly that people have begun to believe that there are no rules. And the rules have changed continuously, supposedly, societal rules anyway. And as a result of that, I think that people, that's where the disturbance comes from, because we all need some form of guidance. Do you agree with that, disagree with that?
Well, I think that is what discombobulates people's lives, is because the changing rules.
Yeah.
But when you orient to principles, which
forever.
Are totally apart from society, you have a changeless core inside yourself that enables you to accommodate all those changes. In fact, not just to accommodate with them, but to run with them.
Yes.
And to optimize the opportunities which those changes bring about. Because down deep inside, it is changeless.
Yeah.
And that's one of the points I try to get across with businesses, because as you know, one of the major challenges is just this dizzying rate of change. And if businesses can get a core set of principles plus a common shared vision and call that their mission statement or their constitution, And if that is truly impregnated throughout the entire culture and people are socialized into it, trained into it, nurtured into it, what happens is that you're creating the soul of the organization.
Yeah.
And if it's based on True North principles, it'll never change.
Yeah.
Those True North principles are going to operate regardless.
Yeah.
So then you can see
Products will change, environments will change, but the people and their mission won't change.
Right.
And that's what holds it all together and makes it grow.
And if you don't have that, you know where people get their security? From their structures and their systems. Mm. That's why...
Which reinforces the inability to change.
It does, because it makes the whole organization
inflexible.
Ill-adaptive.
Yeah.
It can't flex.
Now, people's identity becomes tied to a structure or a set of responsibilities instead of to principles.
They do, and to these rules, then it gives them their predictability in life. See, I can predict it, it's dependable, but then life isn't like that. So unless they start to internalize these, and unless you get the whole culture to internalize it, you're going to have bureaucracy and you can't get rid of it. I'll tell you what worries me the most about polarizing politics, you know, it separates people,
right,
is that it undermines trust.
Yeah.
And when trust is undermined or the emotional bank account gets overdrawn, you cannot change bureaucracy.
And that's where we are a great deal, at least in the political system currently.
It is. And they all claim they want to get rid of the bureaucracy. I mean, we have so many programs that essentially are obsolete in their function but not in their funding.
Yes.
And the reason they can't change it is that you don't have the spirit of peacemaking. You don't have the spirit of synergy. You have the spirit of dichotomizing and separating and contention and adversarialism and legalism and suism. Everyone's suing everybody,
no,
see?
It's out of control. No personal responsibility.
Well, that's right. Everyone's a victim. They're all blaming someone else. But then how are we ever going to get synergy? See, unless you have synergy and an internalization of a common shared value system, they instead get their security from their structures and their systems. And they are going to keep those rigid and strong, and this effort of educational reform, political reform, business reform cannot go except upon the foundation of trust. And trust is based on the foundation of trustworthiness. You can't talk yourself out of problems you behave yourself into. And any effort...
I love that. I've heard you say that
before. Any effort to do so is back into those personality ethic technologies. And I'm not against, by the way, the personality ethic. I believe in it. As long as it comes congruent on the foundation of the character ethic. I believe in PR and human relations techniques and visualization affirmation very, very strongly.
But trying to build with no foundation falls to
the floor.
That's the
whole point.
Yeah. One of the human paradoxes, though, I think, and I'm curious what your view of this is that there's such a strong need for certainty, which principles provide. Yet at the same time, too much certainty, and people seem to be bored. Now, I don't think that's true when it comes to principles, but do you know what I'm saying? People are all out there trying to figure out, they'll have enough certainty if they just know their job will be a certain way, enough certainty if I can just get this relationship, enough certainty if my kids can just get straightened out, enough certainty if, and you hear people talk about all these ways that they're trying to gain certainty, yet if you were totally certain about everything, when, how, who, et cetera, you'd be bored out of your mind. Everybody loves a surprise. How do we resolve the paradox?
Well, as I see it, those people are not principle-centered.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
What they are is they're trying to get certainty in their environment. They're trying to get certainty into their relationships. If they were truly principle-centered, it would create such an optimum looseness and flexibility and adaptability at the edges of their entire life that serendipitous events would happen constantly. Happy surprises would happen constantly. The spirit of variety, the spirit of adventure would be nurtured continuously because, in a sense, once you have a sense of stewardship and you're principle-centered, you don't know how you're going to be used. You don't know what's going to happen in your life, whose lives you'll have an opportunity to bless.
So you live in a state of expectancy, positive expectancy.
Absolutely. You're extremely open, and life becomes such an adventure. And you're not saying, "If only I could finish this." See, because you're not goal-driven. You're not schedule-driven.
Right.
Goals become part of the tools. You set up a schedule, but you're principle and people-driven, not schedule-driven. And that's why left-brain people who are using left-brain, say, management or time management tools, they'll find themselves essentially coming. You know what I say, you lean your ladder against the wrong wall. They get to the top rung. No one on their deathbed ever wished they'd spent more time at the office.
Right.
By the way, I studied the deathbed literature, some of it. I haven't done it systematically like I did the success literature. But literally, I saw a summary of the deathbed literature, and the basic message was all they talked about were relationships and contributions.
Yeah.
They didn't talk at all about things that are so important in day-to-day living.
That makes so much sense. And we all want something that's lasting. Now, if all we do is turn within and look at what those lasting elements truly are, everybody knows what they are. You don't have to be taught those things. Although I think it's great to be coached like anything, and I think that's what hopefully you do and what I attempt to do is really give people some of that coaching. Just get them to remember what they know is true. Socrates said learning is remembering. Earlier on, you were relating to this whole idea of trust, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's the foundation for relationship. And being able to trust yourself, I think, is the foundation for being able to have a sense of self-esteem and know that when you give your word to yourself, you're going to follow through. It's so important.